Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Politics. I'm Tim Jones, and my guests today are Jana Randolph and Alessandro Speciale, co-authors of Mario Draghi, The True Story of the Man Who Saved the Euro. This book was first published in Italian by Rizzoli in 2019 and in an updated version in 2021. Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank from 2011 to 19 and Italy's prime minister from 21 to 22, has acquired mythical status. Taking the ECB's helm 3 years into Europe's seemingly unsolvable financial crisis, Draghi, with his governing approach, diplomatic skills, and willingness to test the boundaries of the bank's mandate, stabilized markets and saved the currency. He will be most remembered for his July 2012 pledge to do, quote, whatever it takes to preserve the euro. The authors write, quote, so simple a phrase delivered at the right time in front of the right audience, it will hang on as a warning to investors when Draghi is long gone, that central bankers in Europe are ready to defend their currency against speculative attacks brought on by people not quite aware of their resolve. According to Draghi's successor, Christine Lagarde, these were, quote, the three most successful words in central banking history. Important they were, yes, critical to the continued existence of the euro even, but there was a lot more to Draghi's ECB than those three magic words. Books from Inside the ECB by Massimo Rastagno and Pedro Gustavo Teixeira have covered these years in broad policy terms, but so far, only Randolph and Speciale have written a reporter's fly-on-the-wall account. Jana Randolph is Bloomberg's senior European economics correspondent based in Frankfurt, and since July, Alessandro Speciale has headed Bloomberg's Zurich Bureau after doing the same in Rome. But before that, he worked with Jana as Bloomberg's ECB correspondent from 2013 until 2019. Hello to you both.
Hello, very good being here.
Hello, happy to be here.
Let's start with the story of how you came to write this book. Who was the first mover? Did you interview officials for it specifically, or did you double it up with the journalism you were doing? And also, how did you break down the chapters between you? So let's start with Jana.
Well, I remember sitting in the office listening to that very famous Draghi speech in London in 2012. And I remember looking at my colleagues and saying, you know, at one point, someday, someone will write a book about this. And of course, nothing came of it for quite some time. But the idea stuck in my head. And about 2 years before the end of his term, that was the moment when it was time to bring it back to life. Alessandro had long arrived by then. So I remember asking him, he looked at me and I think he took like 3 seconds, maybe five, to think about it. And then he said, yes, let's do it. Yeah, and then we started work in early 2018, went back to the archives, looked at the whole body of work we had produced ourselves, what colleagues had written. And then we started to ask more and more and more people. We traveled quite a lot across Europe, went to the US to interview people. In the end, it was about 60 interviews we did. A lot of informal conversations as well. And then, the writing was certainly the hardest part. And I think we shared that quite well, writing and editing each other and stitching it together.
And Alessandro, did you tend to take the lead on the background, the Italian background, or how did it work?
Yeah, I mean, we divided up chapters. So we came up with an outline together, and then we sort of divided chapters in terms of who would do the first draft for each chapter. But Jana had also prepared, and I had added to it a sort of master file with all the information that we wanted to put in. And it was an enormous work and extremely useful because we had a very detailed timeline also on a daily basis of what had happened to Draghi in the ECB and in Europe, connected to links to our stories. And basically, when we finished to write the draft for one chapter, we swapped. So I edited hers, she edited me, and this thing went usually for a couple of rounds. And then I think it's fair to say that it took us a couple of chapters to find our footing. I don't know if this feels when people read it, but I definitely have the feeling that some I'm happier about some of the latter chapters than about the first ones. And the other thing, of course, that I being Italian and Jana being German, and our work language being English, so we wrote the book in English. And then, which was not the native language for any of us, and then the book was translated, including to Italian.
How long was the process, the actual writing process, as opposed to the research?
I think I started the very first chapter in March of 2019, while I was still working, and Alessandro was off, I believe, at that time. But yeah, March, and then we handed in the first draft to the publishers the 4th of July.
That was pretty quick.
Yeah, the bulk of the writing was done in a couple of, I mean, at least on my part, was done in a couple of months that I was on paternity leave. So I was on paternity leave for several months, and two of those I kind of set aside for the book.
Normally, I should say, I interview people about brand new books. They're usually coming out the day of the interview. But the difference with this one was I'm an ECB watcher myself, and I've been waiting for somebody to do for the ECB what Bob Woodward and David Wessel did for the Federal Reserve. So I was pretty excited when I saw the book coming out in Italian and then in Spanish, and I was waiting for it to come out in English, and it never did. Can you tell us what happened there? Well, is there a chance that this book or a version of this book could come out in English in the future?
We've never given up hope, but at this point, it's probably a bit unlikely. And a lot of it comes down to unfortunate timing, I would say. When we went shopping for publishers, a lot of the ones that were based in London, the English-speaking community, it was just after Brexit, and everybody was telling us essentially, well, an EU topic, I'm not sure that's going to fly. Go look somewhere else.
Yeah,
and then we went to the US, and some of them didn't even know who Mario Draghi was. So with you know, time passed, and we were you know, under deadline, of course, because his term was expiring. So we were very happy with, you know, what we found, and with having a chance to publish in Italy and in Italian, because that's where you know, a lot of people are interested in him, and probably most people in Europe that are interested in are in Italy. But yes, I mean, it is unfortunate, and the fact that it was translated into Spanish and into Mandarin is you know, a small in a way making up for it, but not. I would quite like to see an English version.
And let me add to that, and possibly someone is listening to this podcast, is that the Italian publisher Rizzoli has the sort of global rights, including to the English version. A very big literary rights agency had an option for these rights, but as far as we know, nothing has come of it. So, I mean, by all means, go and inquire to Rizzoli if you're interested.
Well, I mean, the obvious book to be written in the future would be a comparison of the Draghi and LaGuardia's, but we'll come back to that. So, coming to the substance of the book, can we do some quick scene setting covering Draghi's unusual childhood, his education in the US, how he came to prominence in the Italian policy world in the 80s and 90s, his experience at Goldman Sachs, and so on. So, Alessandro, could you take us through that?
Yeah, I mean, for someone as reserved as Draghi, there has been a sort of a quite effective myth that has been building about his, how his character developed. And the basic facts are easily told. So Draghi lost both his parents pretty early in the first years after World War II as a teenager. And he was the oldest of several brothers. So he kind of had to also look after them financially, keeping the house organized. He has told about this in one of the very few personal interviews that he gave, which was to the German weekly Die Zeit, which at the time had an Italian-German editor-in-chief. And that's a rare revealing document. And he attended a prestigious high school run by the Jesuits in Rome, which was kind of one of the places where the Italian elite was formed, and then went on to study economics. And one of the things that happened is that Modigliani, a Nobel Prize winner, sent him to study at MIT. Draghi wasn't the first one and wasn't the only one to be sent to MIT by Modigliani, who had a strong relationship with that university. But he was one of the few who stayed on, and rather than being a visiting scholar, a visiting student, stayed there to complete his PhD there, also working, teaching lessons, having a work even in a technology company for a short time to maintain his family at the time. And then he returned to Italy, and what was most likely at the time for most people who knew him is that he would have a brilliant academic career. He quickly moved around various universities in Italy, and I think his last one was in Florence, which was a pretty prestigious one for someone as young as Draghi was at the time. But then something happened that he got into touch with politics, he got into touch with policymaking. It was in the mid-80s, the socialists were the party that was in power with Bettino Craxi in Italy, and it was sent as Italy's representative at the World Bank. He also became an advisor at Bank of Italy, and he started becoming very well known in policy circles at some point, so much so that, and this was really the breakthrough for Draghi, in 1991, he was appointed Director General of the Treasury, which was a kind of a new role, or at least the way that he was really the Mandarin, the leading technocrat in a ministry that was prone to the political instability in Italy. So ministers changed almost every year, while Draghi was in that role for 10 years, and he remained with, I think, 10 or 11 different ministers and upwards of 10 different cabinets. So this stability, and it was at a crucial time for Italy because Italy signed up to the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, as we know, and then was working down its debt, modernizing its economy to prepare for euro accession. And it was extremely complicated times. And that's where Draghi really became one of the leading policy technocratic figures, capable of navigating the sort of treacherous waters of Italian politics, of maintaining the intellectual acumen that made him recognized at an intellectual level, at the same time melding the intellectual aspect and the policy aspect and the compromise aspect that you need when you may need something to happen with policy and making a big bureaucratic machine work.
And what made him move on to the private sector, going to Goldman Sachs from the Treasury?
There's various versions of that can be said, but I think that the most honest version has a name and surname, as we would say in Italian, and that's Giulio Tremonti, who was the mercurial finance minister under Silvio Berlusconi for several of the Berlusconi governments. And the two men, to put it diplomatically, didn't held each other in high esteem reciprocally, and there were several more or less public spats between the two of them, sometimes even visible, with the two of them sitting apart at international gatherings. And so at some point, I mean, he basically came out and said, like, you know, I am moving on. I don't feel welcome here. And after a gardening leave, he went on to look at the private sector. And what's interesting that Jana and I found out during his year at Goldman Sachs is that he really wanted to learn the ropes of markets. He went to sit in with traders, trying to figure out really how these people were doing their job, as opposed to just being a door opener, someone who was bringing contacts with, like, someone with this experience by then was already more than capable of doing.
You talked to Jim O'Neill, who's well-known Goldman Sachs, former Goldman Sachs economist in the UK, about exactly that in the book. And then from there, he became governor of the Bank of Italy, and that was because Tremonti had already moved on?
Yes, no, they continue to be sort of at. So what is interesting is that Draghi was actually selected as governor of the Bank of Italy by Berlusconi himself. But at the same time, he kept on Tremonti, and he kept this sort of low-level tension that sometimes erupted with Tremonti.
So from there, as you write in the book, he came to the presidency of the ECB. It was almost by accident. You know, the French, as you write, had already accepted that Trichet would be replaced by a German, and Vito Constancio, a southerner, had been chosen as vice president. So, Jana, can you give us the background to how that decision was made? How was it that the Germans were unable to get their president and we ended up with Draghi as the president of the ECB?
Yeah, so for a long time, it looked like Axel Weber, the Bundesbank president at the time, was destined to go to the ECB and be the successor of Jean-Claude Trichet. But as we all know, it turned out differently. And I would say there are several reasons for that. One certainly was that the Bundesbank and Bundesbank presidents and policymakers have always had very distinct ideas about what monetary policy in the Eurozone should look like. And Angela Merkel, the chancellor at the time, may have also had a role to play there. Essentially, when you ask people these days, and Axel Weber spoke about it himself, he said it would have been increasingly or very hard for him to, you know, assume the presidency and set policy in a way that he didn't believe was the right way. And nomination for the ECB presidency at the time was taking place in a context where asset purchases first moved onto the ECB's agenda. So if we go back to the Greek crisis, to 2010, there was a time when, you know, there was a lot of turmoil in financial markets and the Greek crisis was in full swing. It was in early May that the ECB had a meeting in Lisbon, as a matter of fact. And Trichet was asked there if asset purchases had been discussed to stabilize financial markets. And he said no. A few hours later, the U.S. stock market slumped. The governing council got extremely agitated at that time because they were wondering whether they had contributed to that. And strangely enough, it was Axel Weber who, after a meeting dinner, said, well, why don't we look into asset purchases? And everybody looked very strangely at the time, that he noticed immediately what he had done, and he backpedaled almost immediately, saying it was, you know, an academic intervention and it shouldn't be taken so seriously. But the idea stuck, and it just took a few days until after the weekend that the securities markets program, the S&P, the very first loan purchase program, was designed and announced. And believe it or not, Weber was the only one who opposed. So that was essentially, in many ways, the beginning of the end of Weber's candidacy for ECB president. So he was opposed. He was concerned about you know, all kinds of things, about monetary state financing, about the difficult incentives such a program would give to governments and fiscal. And then what happened later in the year and late 2010 was that the Italians really started pushing for Draghi, and Merkel, on the other hand, remained silent. And she does these kind of things very well, biding her time, sitting on her hands, and just waiting it out. And that fueled a lot of speculation over whether she wasn't sure, whether she had concerns or doubts, whether Weber didn't want the job. And in the end, it unraveled relatively quickly in the winter of 2011, where he quit. He had to go to the chancellery, and then they had another chat, but it didn't change anything. And immediately after that, there was a lot of speculation whether he resigned in protest because she didn't support him enough and she didn't speak out on his behalf. But he explained a bit later that he was just concerned that he wouldn't be able to be a credible ECB president from a minority position on crucial policy issues. And in many ways, you see with problems Jens Weidmann had during his term, what Weber was concerned about.
You both talk about the very different management style that Draghi introduced when he came into the ECB. He'd already established this at the Bank of Italy. I'll let you both field this. Can you explain how different it was? You have some very funny stories, actually, about his style, but how different it was from Trichet's management style and also, Jana, Christine Lagarde's style. Yeah.
Let me start with Trichet. I mean, he was the best example of a French civil servant. Very diligent, very much by the book, endless meetings until deep into the night. Following procedures, it was tiring for everyone, including himself. So I remember finding him taking a nap on a couch in the press lounge during one conference, many years back, just because it was the first couch he came across when entering the building. That's how exhausted, he and a lot of people were, obviously also because of constant crisis fighting. So yeah, everything was lengthy under Trichet, and he was very much in control of all things at all times. Draghi very much believes in delegating. So if he tells you deal with it, that's exactly what he expects you to do. You're in charge, and you alone are in charge. So Trichet would have checked in with you every 2 hours on progress or given extra instructions. And for Draghi, the problem was to solve. You know, somebody else was dealing with it. That, you know, got a lot of people very confused at the beginning because they were just not used to it. So the easing in, adapting to a new president was quite difficult for a lot of people at the ECB. But really, in the end, my take is that they really appreciated it. So there were no more endless meetings. There was a lot of confidence and trust that once you were put in charge, you got the job done. So a lot of freedom in a way. But also, of course, yeah, Draghi had a very distinct style of decision making, of working with a very small circle of trusted people. And that, of course, left a lot of people who weren't part of that circle on the outside, quite disappointed. And that created a lot of tensions in the governing council.
How did the two contrasting styles compare to, say, with Christine Lagarde's style?
Christine Lagarde is, very different from both of them because what she's good at is listening to people, giving them room to air their thoughts, air their arguments, hear them out, and then searching for common ideas, looking where tensions could be. And then stitching together a consensus that everybody can live with. It's a very respectful environment, very different to Draghi's basically arriving at a meeting with an idea and saying, this is the best idea. I came up with it. I've thought it all through. And you can either say yes. Lagarde hears people out. She tries to learn. And of course, she has her background as a lawyer, as a mediator, helped her in doing that. And that earned her a lot of respect on the governing council. A lot of people, or all people actually really like working with her because they felt heard. And it doesn't mean that every decision needs to be unanimous and every decision is debated in every one, but they feel they had their chance to talk and convince people otherwise. So it's a much more harmonious ECB under President Lagarde than it was under Draghi.
Alessandro, you write about a couple of stories about how he developed this reputation for being Mr. Elsewhere.
Yes. So this was his name at the Bank of Italy, but even before he was the governor, when he was an advisor and also when he was the director general of the Treasury. Draghi doesn't have much patience for endless meetings, as Jana was saying, and is very tight at running the clock and keeping things on time with meetings, and it can be a bit imperious on that. But what is really interesting, I mean, that Jan and I found out, is that a person like Draghi, I think it's fair to say, that has many qualities, intellectual, as an academic, as a sort of a person that can find compromise and all that. But I think possibly a sort of underestimated capacity of a policymaker like him is that he's very good at managing meetings. If you go in a room and Draghi is presiding this meeting, you can be quite sure that Draghi will eventually get what he wanted from this meeting, and that most people in that meeting will come out thinking that they have come out with a solution that fairly represents what they came in wanting. It's very good at sort of managing a room and making sure everyone, as one of the people that we talked to put it, is a fair broker, but at the same time, it doesn't lend the discussion, sort of build a consensus out of itself, but it's managed to create this consensus, which also gives this impression of being sort of imperious and coming in with a prefabricated position. Because, of course, I mean, he very much believes in leadership. He doesn't think that the president of an institution like the ECB should just sort of gather the consensus and ratify what's the mood in the room, so to speak. And there was this anecdote, which I don't think he does anymore, that he used to set his watch 5 minutes early so he could always be on time, and he was always managed to keep a very tight schedule for everyone, so that he didn't restrain himself from cutting someone off when he thought he was going, and sort of bringing it back to the conversation at hand, to the topic of the conversation at hand.
The book really, it covers the whole presidency, but the three huge moments, the first was July 2012, the second was the Greek crisis, or the most acute phase of the Greek crisis in 2015, and then before that, the introduction of quantitative easing in January 2015. You go through the processes that led to each, and they're all very contrasting. So 2012 was done at great speed. The introduction of QE was like turning an oil tanker around. And the Greek case was really interesting in that the ECB hardly took part. They essentially took one big decision, but apart from that, they stood back. I mean, there's three big things to talk about here. So quickly on 2012, you've got really fascinating background to this, and this conversation between him and Herman Van Rompuy about how there'd been a game-changing decision that led to the whatever it takes speech. Can you talk us quickly through the process that led to whatever it takes and to the introduction of outright monetary transactions?
Sure. I mean, there was 2012, the summer of 2012 was a very volatile period in markets. Earlier efforts to stabilize them were waning, so long-term loans and the S&P we talked about. And Draghi was clearly mulling his options, but governments were, until that summit, kind of sitting on their hands, and he wasn't quite sure whether any ECB action would even be successful if governments weren't helping and playing along. And then what happened at that summit is that leaders agreed on a banking union, on facilitating direct capitalization of struggling banks. There was, you know, some budget coordination, more central economic policy making. It was just the plan, all of it. But for Draghi, it was a sign in many ways that governments are finally committing to that union, to making it stronger, and to coming up with a plan to strengthen the foundation. So that was really a turning point for Draghi. The environment in which this took place was one where market speculation just continued. You had downgrades for Italy's credit ratings. You had a bailout of Spanish banks. Looking at Greece, you had riots in the streets and burning places. All across downtown Athens. So it was terrifying in many ways. What we found out was that ECB staff was working on a blueprint of a program. They were looking at what they could do to stabilize the situation. And there was in early July an executive board meeting where people felt that, you know, things were coming together. There were sufficient ideas on the table of how the program could look like, all with very strong conditionality. But no plans were made in that because there was no immediate urgency. That's when Draghi went to London to give his famous speech. And it was the day before the opening of the Olympic Games. It was a big investor conference that he spoke at, where Cameron praised the British economy, endless opportunities for business. And so Draghi was in this environment where there were, there was a lot of energy, a lot of optimism into the future. And at the same time, he was asked a lot of very worrying questions on the state of the Eurozone economy, but met there. And that's when he set out and gave that speech, talking about bumblebees and how the euro is won and should graduate. And it was a very confusing speech initially to a lot of people. And then he had this moment where he looked up and took a break and really looked around the room and then said what he said, we'll do whatever it takes. He did say within our mandate before, but nobody really heard that. As far as he was concerned, he said things that he said a million times before. The ECB is there to defend the euro. But in many ways, the market was listening at this point in time. And not a lot of people heard within our mandate. They heard whatever it takes. Unconditional pledge to support the euro. And that was what really was the turn. After that, things happened relatively quickly. One of the first calls he made was to Weidmann, knowing how he was thinking about these kind of things. And that, as we later learned, didn't really help all that much because the Bundesbank came out very quickly saying they don't want purchases to stabilize markets. But Merkel and Hollande, the French leader at the time, they signaled support, and that was clearly the more important one. And then it happened very quickly. People worked on the plan. They outlined OMT in broad strokes in August. They presented all the details that we know today in September. So it was just a few weeks. In those weeks, the ECB worked on the plan. Draghi went to lawmakers, told them the ECB has lost control of borrowing costs, it needs to intervene to wrest back control. And that plan landed on the table. And a lot of lawyers probably worked through the night on many occasions to make sure it was legally sound. But that's how it happened.
I didn't know until I read your book how bad the relationship actually became between Draghi and Weidmann over time.
Yeah, it was not a nice thing to look at in many ways. There were media reports, you know, some of the time they weren't even on speaking terms. I'm not sure that it went that far. But yes, they really disagreed fundamentally on certain policies. And initially, Draghi tried to smooth over the differences. He talked to German media, tried to address concerns of the German public, promising to be responsible, saying the disagreements were blown out of proportion. But in the end, he just gave up because Weidmann was very, very uncompromising, had his conviction, and he stuck with them. He was very dogmatic in that sense. And it really is a shame because Weidmann is an extremely well-regarded and very good economist, and in many ways a very good Bundesbank president. He was very well-respected in his institution for the economist that he was and is. But for Draghi, Weidmann really took things too far. When the program finally ended up in court, Weidmann stood there and essentially declared that the OMT verges on legally financing government. That is a very dangerous thing to say. So that's really what damaged their relationship beyond repair. Draghi had a nice saying when we spoke about it at one point. He essentially pointed me to a quote by Goethe. Goethe once said, the Germans make everything difficult, both for themselves and for everyone else. And I thought that was very telling of how he viewed the relationship. So for most of the rest of the term, they coexisted, but they didn't really work a lot with each other, because ultimately Draghi could always be very sure about how Weidmann would argue and how what kind of positions he would take, and that it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense to try and turn him around. So, you know, why waste time?
The speed of getting to QE in January 2015, how much of that do you assign to Weidmann himself and the Bundesbank, and how much would have been pretty slow in any case because of all the alternative measures that, as you point out in the book, even Draghi himself thought that some of the credit easing measures were, for some time, would have been sufficient?
Yeah, I think Draghi wasn't unaware of the fact that QE was a very difficult instrument in a currency union where you have different governments, different fiscal policy, where you don't have a joint budget, and a lot of questions needed to be answered before. So if you have another way of reaching the same results, then maybe that is preferable, and that's what we saw. So really, the ECB exhausting every other opportunity, long-term loans, purchasing asset-backed securities, covered bonds. Nothing worked at a large enough scale. So ultimately QE was gonna happen, but still it was difficult. And even when you look at the design of the original APP program, you can really see how they tried to make it palatable to everyone. So there is a lot of the central banks, all the national central banks buy at their own risk. There's no risk sharing. They only buy their own national bonds. So the Bundesbank buying German debt, the Banca d'Italia buying Italian debt. And if one country were to default, that country's central bank would be stuck with the lock. Not that that's an option, but technically that's how the program is set up. Yeah. A very difficult thing to do, but Draghi is the one who got it done, and Draghi is the one who equipped the ECB with a very old monetary policy tool that now is here to stay and that can be used in the future. So that's a big achievement as well.
Alessandro, I just want to touch on the Greek episode. It was very interesting, as you point out in the book, how uninvolved the ECB was. They essentially chucked it into the hands of politicians. Can you take us through that?
It's interesting as a way of how Draghi managed to get things done while remaining very much in the mandate of the ECB that, as we know, is price stability, and at the same time not sticking to a literal interpretation of this. So in the first half of 2015, the situation in Greece was that Syriza, the radical left-wing party, had won elections, was in power. Alexis Tsipras and especially Yanis Varoufakis was the finance minister. And the country was quickly running out of money, which in practice means that Greek banks weren't able to refinance themselves on the market. So finding liquidity to keep paying salaries, to keep the economy going and all that. And the only collateral that they could offer to get this liquidity was Greek government bonds, which, of course, we know at the time, given the situation, weren't very sound, and so couldn't really be accepted to do that. And so the one thing, as you were mentioning before, that the ECB did, which was quite dramatic, was to remove a sort of a special condition that allowed Greek bonds to be used as collateral, even if they didn't respect if you didn't have the right rating for this one. With this waiver gone, the only avenue that Greek banks had to refinance themselves was by posting short-term debt to the Greek central bank through an emergency facility called ELA, but which is something that the National Bank of Greece does, but of course the ECB has to approve each time. And basically, for many months, the ECB kept extending this window that allowed the Greek crisis to play out, the politics and all that. And as the political drama unfolded, Draghi refused to act. And what could the ECB have done? ECB could have done, which would have been a literal interpretation of the law. The Greek bonds are not sound collateral, which most likely they weren't at the time. So it's not possible to keep giving euros in exchange for them, which would have basically meant the collapse of the Greek financial system and most likely triggered the switch of Greece to an alternative currency, an exit of the euro, Grexit and all that, all the things that we were discussing before. But this technicality that Draghi refused to make on sound technical reasons, because he said Greece is still in the euro. No one has said that Greece wants to exit the euro, so Greek bonds are still a valid collateral, allowed the room for politicians to play out all their drama. There was this referendum that then was disattended and eventually come to the 11th hour agreement that we know of. And this is interesting because how Draghi did it was by taking a sort of a strong interpretation of the ECB's mandate. So the mandate of price stability also includes price stability, de facto includes in this interpretation also the preservation of the euro area. And Draghi was saying there has been no political decision for that Greece should or wants to leave the euro. Therefore, I assume that it wants to continue to remain in the euro. And given that Greece wants to continue formally to remain in the euro, then I will continue to extend credit to the Greek financial system. And this was a very clever way of acting without acting and not playing the role of the technocrat. Many politicians in Germany and possibly also in Greece would have been relieved if a technocrat had decided to close the tap, as they said at the time, and trigger the crisis that they were playing on the brink, but nobody wanted to be the one that actually triggered the crisis. And eventually, he steadfastly refused to do this technical step. And eventually politicians walked back and he could say, you see, I was right all along. There was always a political will, which was inscribed in the treaties to keep Greece in the euro. And therefore, my job was to maintain the conditions for this to happen. And eventually the politicians got there. So this was the non-action of the ECB was crucial in that crisis time.
So I've got one last question each for the two of you, starting with Jana. I got the impression in the last, say, year and a half of his presidency that he was in a bit of a hurry and was started to impose his will. He got Philip Lane in as chief economist as core part of his legacy, and he restarted QE, actually against the wishes against the wishes of the German and the French governors at the time. Do you think that's a fair characterization, that he was in a hurry?
I mean, he had a very distinct view of the economy and of the monetary policy. And they probably were distinctly different from the German perception. And by the end, certainly also very different from the perspectives of a lot of his colleagues on the governing council. So, yeah, he was convinced the economy was too weak, that inflation was too weak, that there was a serious risk that we wouldn't reach the 2% or the below, but close to 2%, which the target was when he was president. And in many ways, was done talking about alternatives and different views with people that sometimes believed couldn't reach up to him. I mean, if you look around who's on the governing council, not everybody there is an economist. You have lawyers, you have a lot of political appointees. So a lot of people do not have intellectual capabilities, the economic excellence that Draghi has. And that, I think, after a very demanding presidency, just maybe got the better of him a little bit. He had very distinct views on what was necessary to make sure the economy, that inflation reaches the target. I think in the end, it was also about cementing his legacy. About making sure that policy is locked in for a while, even after he's gone. At President Lagarde, there was a lot of things were said about her before she started, not being an economist, being more interested in the, you know, more of the side topics, I would say, on climate change, on inequality. And maybe there was a feeling that it might be necessary to lock in policy to give her a bit of time to catch up on what it is like to run a central bank and an institution like the ECB.
And Alessandro, I'm thinking of his short career after the ECB as Italian prime minister. The hopes when he came in were ridiculously high. It was like the second coming. And yet, if you look at what's happened since, you know, every ECB rate rise, there are these political protests in Italy. Does he have a legacy? If you look at what has happened since his premiership, has he left something behind?
The one legacy that he has left to his to the current government, to Giorgia Meloni's government, was the 209 billion euro that Italy has secured from European partners as part of NGEU, about one third grants and two thirds loans. And the program was basically written under Draghi in a very short time. His predecessor, Giuseppe Conte, had an extremely sketchy, had been working on this for months and months, but in the end left basically nothing. And so Draghi's administration in the very first months had to get up and running very quickly the distribution of the vaccine, which was again lagging behind in Italy, so as to allow the reopening of the economy, because of course Draghi came in the middle of the COVID crisis, and prepare this plan, which was eventually approved by Italy's European partners, and therefore now Italy has access to this money. And now, of course, the big problem that Italy has and on which Draghi has no oversight is the actual implementation. Of course, given that it was a mammoth program and that it was done in a very short period of time, there are parts that are probably not 100% easy and possible and realistic to implement, especially after the Ukraine war. The other thing that Draghi did as prime minister was putting Italy, winning even Draghi's initial personal misgivings himself or doubt, or just simply if he wasn't fully aware of the situation, of putting Italy 100% resolutely in the pro-Ukraine camp, despite Italy's long-running deep ties to Russia, thanks to his big communist party, thanks to the fact that a lot of the political elite, starting with Berlusconi and Salvini, the current deputy prime minister, were deeply compromised with the Russian regime. And Draghi instead, at some point, ditched sort of also concerns of the strong economic ties that Italy had with Russia and put Italy resolutely in the pro-Ukraine, pro-NATO, pro-EU camp. And this is a legacy that is holding for now. And for now, Italy has been dispersed a sizable part of the EU money, even though implementation is lagging behind, so the last installments haven't been received yet by Italy. And I would say, despite this, which is quite significant for what was a short-lived government, even by Italian standards, is that even though all of this, in the end, Italian politics had the better of Draghi in a way. Draghi was a candidate, even if he was not ever officially in the ballot, to become Italian president at the beginning of 2022. It's not clear whether he really wanted the job or he just was sort of sure that he would get the job no matter what, and therefore sort of had made his peace with that. But what is true is that Italian politicians in the Italian parliament never wanted to have someone like Draghi at the pinnacle of Italian politics and of the Italian system of power. And after that plan, if it ever was a plan, or even after the possibility dissolved, then the viability of Draghi's very disparate, almost national unity majority was destined to splinter, which happened only a few months later. And then we had early elections and all that. So in the end, the small politics of Italy had the better, even of someone like Draghi.
Yeah. Well, because this is a podcast about books, to sign off as usual, I've asked my guests to recommend a couple each. preferably one broadly from the field and one personal choice. And anyone who follows Alessandro on Twitter knows he's been doing this for years, so we'll be lucky to keep him to two. So starting with Jana, what have you chosen?
I chose one book that deeply inspired me in my early years of journalism. It's called Rebel Radio by José Ignacio López Vigil. And that is the story of guerrilla radio station operating during the civil war in El Salvador in 1979-1992, where people broadcast from the mountain jungle and told about the hardships of that civil war. So that's on the nonfiction front. And then for book that I regularly go back to, that I think everybody should read, is Fabian, The Story of a Moralist by Evichtes, a German author, which essentially tells the story of the collapse of the Weimar Republic. Very much a story about Germany's lost generation right before the Nazis took power. A very powerful book, and if you haven't read it, you should.
Right, I haven't, so I will. Thank you. Alessandro, what have you got?
On fiction, I was tempted to cheat and actually go with two fiction books, but no, I will stick to the rules, but can only wholeheartedly recommend Jana's suggestion of Fabian. It's really an exceptional, unbelievably modern book. No, for fiction, I want to recommend The Magician by Colm Tóibín. It is basically a novelized history of the life of Thomas Mann, and I read it a few months ago. And it made me remember why I was so a bit obsessed by Thomas Mann as a teenager. Probably I wasn't a very fun teenager. And because he's a very complex man, probably on the outside, and it shines through the book. On the surface, a rather unpleasant man, but at the same time, with the depths of vision and of interest for humanity, which informs his books. And if you haven't, I mean, basically one of the best things that this book did was prompt me to reread the Buddenbrooks and other books by Thomas Mann, which are absolutely astonishing. And if you think that Mann wrote the Buddenbrooks when he was 26, it's even more absolutely unbelievable. And as for nonfiction, it's a book by Andrea Wolf, who is a German historian living in the UK, and it's called Magnificent Rebels. It's about an incredible time in the history of European culture and European history overhaul, which was when over a period of about 10 years in Jena, in what once Eastern Germany, not too far from Weimar, lived together and quarreled, exchanged lovers, made friends, drank together, exchanged ideas, an unbelievable bunch of people, Goethe, that Jana was mentioned before, Schiller, Hegel, Schelling, Fichte, the brothers Schlegel, the brothers Humboldt, and a lot of other sort of minor characters, including an extraordinary woman who will end up being Arthur Wilhelm Schlegel's wife. And it's a fantastic story. It's an extremely well-researched book. It could also be an excellent Netflix series. It's intellectually stimulating, and it's just a great story and a great bunch of characters all brought together. And it ends with the famous Battle of Vienna, where Napoleon beat the Prussian kingdom, and Hegel manages to escape that, and even more surprisingly, his big book, The Phenomenology of the Spirit, the manuscript manages to escape just before the war. It couldn't be true. You couldn't make it up, but it's actually true.
Well, today I've been talking to Jana Randolph and Alessandro Spacciale about Mario Draghi, The True Story of the Man Who Saved the Euro, published by Rizzoli. Thank you both for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.